All right, if you have your Apocrypha, let's open up to 1 Maccabees. We're actually going to be reading out of 1 Maccabees today. Brian's like, he's going to have Catholic flashbacks over there. So he's going to like start saying the rosary and like burning incense or something over here. We do have a lack of incense burning here. We do. Maybe that's on purpose, though. All right. So we are going to talk today, if I can talk, about the Maccabean revolts. The Maccabean revolts. So it actually helps set the stage for one of the key theological concepts of the first century, which we'll get to at the end. And I think I'm going to have one more week in this, and then we'll be done. So believe it or not, this actually should be a 4-week series, like I said. That's possible. It's possible. We'll see if there are any other tangents I can scrounge up on this. But most people know this as, you know, like I said, it's called the Maccabean Revolt. Anybody know where the term Maccabean comes from? And it's not from 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Diane said it's somebody's name. That is correct. It's actually somebody's nickname. So Judas Maccabean became known as Judas the Maccabee. And the word Maccabee stems from the root word for hammer. So he was basically, it's Judas the Hammer. So it almost sounds like a wrestling nickname, doesn't it? So it's not, though. You know, I don't think he's doing pile drivers from the top rope or anything like that, but he's pretty impressive regardless. So Judas the Hammer is what that name actually translates to. So that's why it's the Hammer Revolt, which when you get back into the topic here and you get back into the subject matter, it's pretty cool. It's actually pretty cool. But let's go ahead and start off with a word of prayer, and then we'll dive on in. Heavenly Father, we do thank you for another Lord's Day that we can come together, open up some history and figure out what happened with this intertestamental period, Father, that led to the time of Christ being the way that it was, and help us to get a clearer understanding of the cultural and historical aspects of the first century. Thank you for preserving this history, and may it encourage us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right, so let's dive on in. The way that the crisis started is interesting. It reminds me that when the Greeks took over, and the Persians too, it reminds me of what England did in the beginning with the United States when they had the period of benign neglect. Remember we went over that? We were going over Romans 13. They had that period of benign neglect where they said, hey, you guys set your own laws. You're going to have your own governing bodies. We're going to leave you alone. Make sure trade goes back and forth. Make sure we make some money. And we're just going to leave you alone. All right. And then all of a sudden, someone decided, no, we're not going to do that. You guys got a lot of money and we want it. And we're going to micromanage you to squeeze more out of you. Reminds me of this a little bit. So we know how the Persians operated. They gave them a lot of freedom. And Antiochus III also gave them a lot of freedom. So just to recap a little bit of what we talked about last week, the Charter of Rights that Antiochus III gave them granted them very practical pieces here. So they had temple autonomy. Now, what that meant is that the Jews could control who could enter the temple. They managed their own temple finances. So remember how back in the Roman days, they had control over who could enter the temple. Remember, that's one of the things that caused Paul to get arrested, was they thought that he had brought Trophimus, a Greek, in there with him and brought him in and had defiled the temple. Now, the Jews also managed their own finances. They had a treasury that was separate from the state funds, and they could collect the half shekel tax that Moses instituted in the law, and they could collect it from the whole empire. So the Jews in Alexandria, I think, well, no, that would have been under the Ptolemy's control. So I'm not sure. I'd have to check that out. I'm not sure if the Jews would have to, and Alexander would have to pay if they were still under the Ptolemy control. Maybe not. But all of the Jews in the Seleucid branch of the empire would have to pay that half shekel tax. So money was now starting to come back into the temple on a pretty widespread basis. Sabbath observance was protected as well. Jewish soldiers in the Seleucid army were excused from duty on the Sabbath. Jewish merchants couldn't be forced to trade on the Sabbath. And court proceedings involving Jews couldn't be held on the Sabbath. So he gave these guys a lot of freedom, which you can imagine for the Jews would have been very, very welcome. We can practice our law. We have the Greeks for security. We have our own temple treasury, and they're going to honor our Sabbath. And those were some of the big issues, wasn't it? So, hey, we can coexist here. Yeah, there's some Hellenization coming in, but it's not anything necessarily more than what they were already used to. So everything was okay. And here's what was nice. Antiochus III provided some things for the temple that they needed for sacrifices as well. So 20,000 measures of wheat for grain offerings, 2,500 measures of salt for sacrifices, and wood from the Lebanese forest for the altar fire. So not only were they allowing them freedom, they were providing a little bit. So this is a little bit more like the way the Persians were, wasn't it? The Persians said, you guys give them what they need to rebuild the temple. And they had a provision for that. Then Antiochus IV comes on to the scene. And he took on the name Epiphanes. Anybody know what that name Epiphanes means?
Realization.
Not realization. Means glorified one. Where he actually viewed himself as a godlike figure. That's what that name means. So he probably had a very humble, meek view of himself. He was probably, you know, more of a wallflower kind of a guy and just kind of stayed in the back and didn't want a lot of pomp and circumstance made about him, right? No, he's like, I'm a godlike figure. I am a glorious figure that you need to pay attention to. So he brings in a guy by the name of Jason as the high priest. And we talked about this last week. They constructed a gymnasium near the Temple Mount. And the young priests were forced to go in there and to be involved. And they had to exercise au naturel, which offended their sensibilities tremendously and caused a lot of offense. The priestly garments were also changed. The turban that the high priest would wear was replaced with more of a Greek-style headdress. So he's now starting to make the priests look more like Greek pagan priests. Now you can imagine how that went over, right? This was not something that the conservative, God-fearing, law-abiding Jews were interested in it all, and plus a lot of the priests. You start changing the way the dress goes, you're going to then be able to move into the actual practice of idolatry a lot easier. The traditional party resisted in a lot of different ways. So the ones who were more conservative, they actually took to secret to start to train people in the law, had secret synagogues. They did study groups in caves. They developed a code so that they wouldn't be found out. These are the things that I found in some of the research. And that they had this guerrilla religious movement, grassroots, hidden from the Greeks on getting the people to understand the true nature of the law. Then when things got worse, and we talked about this a little bit last week, the treasury temple raids, they took the golden altar, the menorah, the showbread table, they stripped the gold plating from the temple walls. They basically plundered all of these things. They had religious restrictions about meeting. The Sabbath enforcement changed as well. Markets were forced to be open on the Sabbath. Military patrols check for compliance. Dietary laws. This is actually the thing that caused the Maccabean revolt to start. This was one of the things. They would go through the nation and make people eat pork. Now, for us, we think, okay, that's not a big deal for us. All foods are clean. But for a godly Jew, that is the height of offense for them personally to have to engage in something like this. So that's what they forced these people to do. And there was a single event in a small village that actually sparked the Maccabean revolt, and it centers around this, which we'll get to in just a moment. Then there was a temple desecration that took place. I believe it's either 168 or 167. The altar of Zeus was placed over the Jewish altar. That's bad. First, you get the high priest's headdress to change, his garments to change. And now, let's just go ahead and finish it. Let's just go ahead and put the altar of Zeus over the altar of Yahweh. They installed Greek statues in the temple courts. And the daily sacrifice was replaced with pagan offerings. The book of Daniel, and I think this is what I want to go into next week. The book of Daniel talks about this in detail. And I want to go through and discuss this, because some people take this to be like the future temple an abomination of desolation. That's not what Daniel's talking about. He's talking about this time frame right here. And so maybe I think we're going to go through that next week, because I think that would be a good thing to go through. But Daniel prophesied about this. Another reason why they say Daniel wasn't written until around this time frame to make it look like history instead of prophecy. But Daniel's pretty awesome with this. So they replaced they stopped the sacrifices to Yahweh and created sacrifices to the pagan Greek pantheon of gods. And they sacrificed a pig on the altar. So again, very bad. And I haven't found a lot of evidence around this, but it wouldn't surprise me that they started having temple prostitution going on out of the temple during this time frame. So I did see a little blurb about that. I don't know how accurate that is. Circumcision was banned. Again, this guy's intense, isn't he? Because he wanted to destroy any identity that these people had with their religion. Birth records had to use Greek names. And I read, and again, there's there's piecemeal information about these types of things. One of the things that I found was that Torah scrolls were burned publicly and that prayer gatherings were prohibited as well. So we're talking about a full-scale attempt to try to erase all of the worship and service to Yahweh in the Jewish life at this particular time frame. Again, this is within like a 10-year time period. All right. Then we have something called, and I don't know how to pronounce this, the Modiin. It's spelled M-O-D-I-I-N, if you want that. This happened in 167. I'm going to give you the overview, and then we're going to read out of 1 Maccabees. I think this is be the first time I've ever read out of an apocryphal book in the assembly. But again, it's good history. It's good history. It's not inspired. Check out the episode coming out on the 14th. It's not inspired, but it does provide good history. So a Seleucid officer named Apelles arrived to enforce new policies. He set up a portable altar in the village, and he demanded a pig to be sacrificed on it and required the village to participate. And so what you have is a man by the name of Mattathias. He's Judas's dad. He was a priest in this village. Matter of fact, tell you what, I want to read it because it's actually super cool, the story here. So 1 Maccabees, if you're taking notes, 1 Maccabees chapter 2, and we're going to start in verse 15. It says, the officers of the king in charge of enforcing the apostasy came to the city of Modin to make them sacrifice. Many of Israel joined them, but Mattathias and his sons drew together. Then the officers of the king addressed Mattathias and said, you are a leader, an honorable and great man in the city, supported by sons and kindred. Come now, be the first to obey the king's command, as all the Gentiles and Judeans and those who are left in Jerusalem have done. Then you and your sons shall be numbered among the king's friends, and you and your sons shall be honored with silver and gold and many gifts. But Mattathias answered in a loud voice, although all the Gentiles in the king's realm obey him, so that they forsake the religion of their ancestors and consent to the king's orders. Yet I and my sons and my kindred will keep the covenant of our ancestors. Heaven forbid that we should forsake the law and the commandments. We will not obey the words of the king by departing from our religion in the slightest degree. As he finished saying these words, a certain Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice on the altar in Modin according to the king's order. When Mattathias saw him, he was filled with zeal. His heart was moved, and his just fury was aroused, and he sprang forward and killed him upon the altar. At the same time, he also killed the messenger of the king who was forcing them to sacrifice, and he tore down the altar. Thus he showed his zeal for the law, just as Phinehas did with Zimri, son of Salu. And then Mattathias cried out in the city, "Let everyone who is zealous for the law and who stands by the covenant follow me." Then he and his sons fled to the mountain, leaving behind in the city all their possessions. Isn't that cool? Again, good history. It's not inspired, but it's good. It's really good history. So you see what happened there. I mean, and when I was reading the story, I didn't even know that he was going to talk about Phinehas. But that's exactly the account that came to my mind. Back in the law, in Numbers, when Balaam had talked about putting the Midianite women in front of the men of Israel to make them sin, and one of the princes of Israel went in with one of these Midianite women in front of everybody into his tent, and then Phinehas, who had zeal, went in and pinned both of them to the ground with a spear. Remember that? It's pretty awesome. That's what it reminded me of here. And that's exactly what Mattathias did. And this event is what catapulted the Maccabean revolt into the open. So what ends up taking place is that they recognize something. The Greeks were the superpower of the day. Now, Rome was coming up, but the Greeks still were the superpower of the day. And they had thousands upon thousands upon thousands of highly trained military in the area. So they recognized that the only way that they were going to be able to win this victory, to win these battles, was to engage in some guerrilla warfare. And so history should show that it is very, very difficult to defeat a guerrilla army. I don't mean an army of guerrillas, but a guerrilla army. I mean, history shows that over and over and over again. Unless you go in and just wipe every, you have to actually have a very brutal policy of wiping everything out in order for that to work. If you allow that to coexist, the guerrilla army is just gonna bleed you slowly dry. And I think our modern history should let us know that that's the case. I mean, World War II, utter annihilation. It was the only way that that was going to work. They didn't do that in Korea. And what happened in Korea? We had this long, protracted war, and the two sides still exist today, right? Still hostile. Vietnam, same thing, right? Afghanistan, same thing. I mean, Iraq, you could say that we achieved the objectives in Iraq, but basically we established a, an Iranian satellite state controlled by very hostile militant Muslims. So, and it made it very difficult for Christians to exist in the nation of Iraq, by the way, as well. What was that, Chad? But we declared victory. Yes, sir. We did. Yeah. We did. So these guys engaged in guerrilla warfare, and they ended up, spoiler alert, you probably figured this out, they ended up winning, right? So they used caves, they created supply networks through the village. They had small unit structures. They grouped in, their units of like 10 and 20 men. Each one had a local guide. They used shepherd networks for intelligence. I mean, it was just brilliant what they did. They would hit the garrisons when they weren't looking or when they weren't expecting it. So I'm going to go through a few of the battles here, and I just thought that they were pretty cool. You had the first one, the real one of the big ones was the Battle of Beth Horon in 166. And this was in the hill country of Judea. It was a pretty strategic located. You had the Seleucid army was commanded by a guy named Sauron, not Sauron, but Sauron. I just think that's really funny. And he was a high-ranking officer, and he was sent with a large force to crush this just small little insignificant Maccabean revolt. So his forces were significantly larger. However, Judas used guerrilla tactics and the natural terrain to his advantage. So here's what happened. And tell me if this sounds familiar. Very rugged terrain, and the pathways would go in and they would get hemmed in on the sides by the mountains so that only a few of the soldiers could actually go through. Does that sound familiar? What's that sound like? Battle of Thermopylae. Same type of thing that happened earlier. I don't know if they had heard about that and used it, but it makes sense. So what do you do? If you fight a large army on an open field and you're a small group, you're going to get beat. It's just the way it is. But if you use the terrain to your advantage, which they did, and they just pelted these guys and just side attacks and all these types of things, and they killed thousands of them. And then they ran away. It was brilliant. So this started to change the morale of the Israelites. They thought, this might actually work. Now, what had happened, though, is Mattathias died. I don't think he died in this battle. The book of Maccabees just says he died. Doesn't say how. But what ends up happening is that leadership was transferred then to his son, Judas. One of the big events happened in the Battle of Emmaus in 166. So I'm going to read this to you as well here. 1 Maccabees chapter 3 and down to verse 38. This is a little bit of a longer one. So the main guy in this one, his name is Lysias. And it says, Lysias chose Ptolemy, son of Dorymenes, and Nicanor and Gorgias, powerful men among the king's friends. And with them, they sent 40,000 foot soldiers and 7,000 cavalry to invade and ravage the land of Judah, according to the king's orders. That's a significant force. 40,000 infantry, 7,000 cavalry. Then setting out with their whole force, they came and pitched their camp near Emmaus in the plain. When the merchants of the region heard of their prowess, they came to the camp bringing huge sum of silver and gold along with fetters to buy Israelites as slaves. A force from Edom and from Philistia joined with them. So basically they thought, okay, this 47,000 strong army is gonna have no problem beating these guys. And a lot of the people from around there that hated the Jews, specifically people from Edom and Philistia, came and they brought fetters with them so that they could buy the Jews as slaves after the battle. Now, this is going to help us understand why John Hyrcanus or Hyrcanus went and force converted all the Edomites and took those guys over afterwards, because they did this with the Greeks. So it says, Judas and his brothers saw that evils had multiplied and that armies were encamped within their territory. They learned of the orders which the king had given to destroy and utterly wipe out the people. So they said to one another, let us raise our people from their ruin and fight for them and for our sanctuary. The assembly gathered together to prepare for battle and to pray and ask for mercy and compassion. Jerusalem was uninhabited like a wilderness. Not one of her children came in or went out. The sanctuary was trampled on and foreigners were in the citadel. It was a habitation for Gentiles. Joy had disappeared from Jacob and the flute and the harp were silent. Thus they assembled and went to Mizpah near Jerusalem, because formerly at Mizpah there was a place of prayer for Israel. That day they fasted and wore sackcloth. They sprinkled ashes on their heads and tore their garments. They unrolled the scroll of the law to learn about the things for which the Gentiles consulted the images of their idols. They brought with them the priestly garments, the first fruit, and the tithes, and they brought forward the Nazarites who had completed the time of their vows. And they cried aloud to heaven and said, what shall we do with these? And where shall we take them? For your sanctuary has been trampled on and profaned, and your priests are in mourning and humbled. Now the Gentiles are gathered together against us to destroy us. You know what they plot against us. How shall we be able to resist them unless you help us? Then they blew the trumpets and cried out loudly. After this, Judas appointed officers for the people, over thousands, over hundreds, over fifties, over tens. They proclaimed that those who were building houses or were just married or who were planting vineyards and those who were afraid could each return home according to the law. Then the army moved off and they camped south of Emmaus. Judas said, arm yourselves and be brave. In the morning, be ready to fight these Gentiles who have assembled against us to destroy us and our sanctuary. It is better for us to die in battle than to witness the evils befalling our nation and our sanctuary. Whatever is willed in heaven will be done. So this is just the lead up to the battle. This is pretty cool stuff, isn't it? I mean, they only had, I think if I remember correctly, yeah, Judas, so 47,000 against 6,000. Against 6,000 highly trained Greek soldiers using phalanx type movements that the Romans used to use to great success. Now let's read about the battle. This is really cool. This battle sequence is really interesting. Now Gorgias took 5,000 infantry and picked 1,000 cavalry, and this detachment set out at night in order to fall upon the camp of the Jews in a surprise attack. Some from the citadel were his guides. Judas heard of it and himself set out with his soldiers to attack the king's army at Emmaus while these forces were still scattered away from the camp. So what happened is Gorgias, one of the generals, took a few thousand, 5,000 plus 1,000 cavalry, and they knew where Judas was camped at, and they went and they were going to attack him at night. Judas heard about it. That left 42,000 plus 5,000 back at the main camp. Judas said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and take my army and I'm going to go attack that group. So he left at night to go attack the main group. Pretty cool. This guy's, you see why they call him the hammer? This guy's pretty awesome. So during the night, Gorgias came into the camp of Judas and found no one there. So he sought them in the mountains saying, they are fleeing from us. But at daybreak, Judas appeared in the plain with 3,000 men. Furthermore, they lacked the helmets and swords they wanted. They saw the army of the Gentiles strong, breastplated, and flanked with cavalry and made up of experienced soldiers. Judas said to the men with him, do not fear their numbers or dread their attack. Remember how our ancestors were saved in the Red Sea when Pharaoh pursued them with an army. So now let us cry to heaven in the hope that he will favor us. Remember the covenant with our ancestors. Destroy this army before us today. All the Gentiles shall know there is one who redeems and delivers Israel. That's so cool, man. I mean, like I said, this is great history. It's not inspired, but it's just showing what these guys did. And there's really not a lot of doubt about the truthfulness of this history. All right. So here's where it gets good. Not that it hasn't gotten good. It says, when the foreigners looked up and saw them marching toward them, they came out of their camp for battle. The men with Judas blew the trumpet and joined the battle. They crushed the Gentiles who fled toward the plain. Now, what some of the other history states as you read it, they weren't ready. They were still having breakfast. The Greeks were. And that's when they got attacked. So they weren't necessarily ready for the onslaught, and Judas just was able to take them out. How strong of an army or how well trained were these guys that they were able to take on that force much larger and rout them? I mean, when you're fighting for your home versus being a mercenary, there's a whole lot more motivation that goes along with that. And invading armies, they know that, and it's a difficult thing to win. So the Greeks, their whole rear guard fell by the sword, and they were pursued as far as Gazara and the plains of Idumea and to Azotus in Jamnia. About 3,000 of their men fell. When Judas and the army returned from the pursuit, he said to the people, do not be greedy for the plunder, for there is a fight ahead of us, and Gorgias and his army are coming near us on the mountain. But now stand firm against our enemies and fight them. Afterwards, you can freely take the plunder. As Judas was finishing this speech, a detachment appeared looking down from the mountain. They saw their army had been put to flight and their camp was burning. The smoke they saw revealed what had happened. When they realized this, they completely lost heart. And when they also saw the army of Judas in the plain ready to attack, they all fled to the land of the foreigners. Judas went back to plunder the camp, and they took as much gold and silver, cloth dyed blue and marine purple, in great treasure. And they returned. As they returned, they were singing hymns and glorifying heaven, who is good, whose mercies endure forever. Thus Israel experienced a great deliverance that day. This was actually the turning point of the revolt. The battle before that was great, but it wasn't to this extent. Right. So here they were able to put aside or to destroy an army that was much bigger and much stronger than them. The last battle that we'll talk about is called the Battle of Beth Zur, and that happened in 164. And this is what led to them completely removing them from the land. Now, when I say completely remove them, it allowed them to have control of Jerusalem back. But there were still battles that took place after that, that they still had to continue to fight for about another 20 years or so. But they weren't consistent, and the Greeks never regained control of Jerusalem. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and read you the one over Lysias here so that you can see the last one. All right. It says, but, and this is right after the verse I just stopped reading. It says, but those of the foreigners who had escaped went and told Lysias what had occurred. When he heard it, he was disturbed and discouraged because things had not turned out in Israel as he intended and as the king had ordered. So the following year, he gathered together 60,000 picked men and 5,000 cavalry to fight them. They came into Idumea and camped at Beth Zur, and Judas met them with 10,000 men. So their forces grew as well. Seeing that the army was strong, he prayed, blessed are you, Savior of Israel, who crushed the attack of the mighty one by the hand of your servant David and delivered the foreign camp into the hand of Jonathan, the son of Saul, and his armor bearer. Give this army into the hands of your people, Israel. Make them ashamed of their troops and their cavalry. Strike them with cowardice. Weaken the boldness of their strength and let them tremble at their own destruction. Strike them down by the sword of those who love you, and that all who know your name may sing your praise. Then they engaged in battle, and about 5,000 of Lysias' army fell in hand-to-hand fighting. When Lysias saw that the tide of the battle turning and the increased boldness of Judas, whose men were ready either to live or to die nobly, he withdrew to Antioch and began to recruit mercenaries so as to return to Judea with greater numbers. And that was the end of Lysias. Their empire started to fall apart, and Antiochus IV had died. They never came back in with larger numbers. Now, what happened after that is where we get to the rededication of the temple. And we'll read about that here in a second. But any questions or comments about those battles or their attitude toward anything, any of that? That's pretty good stuff, though, isn't it? Why did some in the early church accept the Apocrypha and others didn't? We think of the Apocrypha as just a lot of weird stuff, and there is some weird stuff in there. Don't get me wrong. This is some of the really good history that some people just mistakenly have turned into doctrine. Now, there are some weird stuff in Maccabees. Okay, there is. There's like prayers for the dead, and purgatory is based on. That's found in here. That's why we don't use these things for doctrine, but we can use them for history. So again, I just want to emphasize that. So who knows about Hanukkah? Who knows about the history of Hanukkah? Besides the Adam Sandler song that I think people are probably smiling about. So there's a miracle associated with Hanukkah, right? Anybody remember what that is? Okay, so the miracle associated with Hanukkah is apparently during the rededication of the temple, they only had enough consecrated oil to last one day, and somehow miraculously it lasted 8 days. I had a very, very, very hard time tracking that down because it's not in the history or the Apocrypha or any of it. Where that actually comes from is from the 5th century AD in the Babylonian Talmud, and this is a legend that got pulled out of the Babylonian Talmud that got inserted into Hanukkah. And there seems to be a reason for that is because, of course, the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, this was designed to show spiritual perseverance instead of military might. Because one of the things that was taking place during the time of Christ is that they had the Feast of Dedication. That's what Hanukkah means, Feast of Dedication. Jesus celebrated it. It's in the Gospel of John. You can see it in there. But what they did is they celebrated the military conquest, kind of like what they did with the Feast of Purim, with the celebration of Esther, with the victory over Haman. So you have these two feasts that weren't prescribed by the law, but they were celebrated during the time of Christ, and Jesus went ahead and celebrated that Feast of Dedication that we know about. So, but it didn't have this fake miracle from legend associated with it at this particular time. So I thought that was interesting because I was really trying to figure out where did this whole, you know, it was an 8 day festival, but where did the whole miraculous burning of the candle come from? It's made up and there's really no evidence for it at all. Because you would think, if that was part of it, it would be in Maccabees. It would be in the history, but it's not. Now, it might be getting conflated with something that's found in 2 Maccabees. And that in 2 Maccabees, they talk about how the temple was rededicated and that Nehemiah supposedly found this liquid. They were supposed to have left the fire burning from the altar and hit it so that when they were restored, they could rekindle the altar, and that there was this dark liquid in that place. And Nehemiah took it and poured it over the sacrifice. And then the sun beat down on it and it burst into flames. And thus the sacrifice was restored. You know, maybe they took that piece of legend from Maccabees and conflated it with something else. I don't know. It's interesting, but there's not really anything that corroborates that. Oh, in the Battle of Bethzur, I forgot about this. It's not in Maccabees, but it's in here. You know what else Lysias had with him? Battle elephants. And I've read different ways that they did that, but basically they did what you see in Lord of the Rings and the Return of the King. They aim for the heads. In other words, what they did is they didn't go fight the elephants specifically. They went after the people that were on the elephants. And that helped destroy and neutralize that. But they also used the terrain, because remember, they were on a big, broad plain. They used the terrain around it to upset those guys and not be able to use them. Super smart. Super smart. So the temple recapture and purification, they go in, the temple is empty, but the citadel, there's still some people there. So Judas sends some people out to the citadel, to destroy those guys. And they fasted, they wept, they tore their garments when they saw what had happened, because the temple was really trashed. You know, the temple, the altar of Zeus was there. They destroyed the temple or the priestly quarters. Things were burned. Weeds were growing up everywhere. It was in complete and utter disrepair. So what they did is they removed the Greek altars and they threw them in the Valley of Ben-Hinnom. They built a new altar there and they used unhewn stones per the law and moved those in. They created new temple vessels and they had a dedication ceremony and rededicated the temple. Now, after this is when the Hasmonean dynasty gets established. Now, I'm a curious type of guy. So when I see words that I don't know what they are, I want to know where they came from. I like etymologies. I think they're great. I want to find out where these things come from. So that's why, you know, the whole worship thing. That's why I'm like, yeah, that word worship isn't even a real word when it comes to this. It's really, you know, prostrating yourself in submission and, you know, change the definition to the right definition and all the confusion goes away. So I'm like, where did this term Hasmonean come from? Nobody knows. They think it was Mattathias' great-grandfather who had that name associated with him, but they really don't know where the name Hasmonean comes from. We don't know. I'm sure they did. We don't. But the Hasmonean dynasty, a line of people, and suffice it to say, what ends up taking place is you have a mixture of the high priesthood with king. Now, the king didn't come about automatically, right? You have, after Judas passed away, you have his brother Jonathan that takes over, and then you have Simon who takes over after that, and they get, especially Simon, he was called the leader slash ethnarch forever. Or sorry, a leader and high priest forever. So there you have the actual full-fledged joining of the priesthood and the kingship. And then a little bit after that is when they finally started calling him king. Now, this guy Simon, when he gets laid aside to do this, everything he said was to be done and nothing could be questioned and nothing could be appealed. That sounds like a king to me. Right? That's absolutely a king. All right, let's talk about some of the consequences and we'll be done for today. So what ends up taking place is, as they continue to do this, they build their own military. And like I said, they go and they conquer Samaria. They conquer Galilee. They bring the Edomites into the nation and forcefully convert them, which always works as well, doesn't it? The Hellenization continued, but it was definitely not as extreme. They still had the gymnasiums, but they had a men's gym and a ladies gym, and you could wear your clothes. It was a tremendous advantage for the people there. The social impact. This is where the priest, if you remember during the time of Christ, the priests almost are like this high level aristocracy, aren't they? That control everything. This is where that came from. The priest having all this political power, having all of this wealth, having all of this control, being the ruling class of the nation of Israel during the time of the Romans, that came from this blending of priest and king that took place during the Hasmonean dynasty. And something else that I thought was really interesting. You get to the New Testament age. What did they expect the Messiah to be? A military leader. Do you want to know one of the main reasons why? Because of the Maccabean revolt. Because the Maccabean revolt was able to expel the Greeks. And who came after the Greeks? The Romans. And so they expected the Messiah to be a military leader to expel the Romans, just like Judas did with the Greeks. It was now ingrained in their DNA. And because of that cultural surrounding, that cultural milieu that was around them, that was the framework by which they went and interpreted the messianic passages back in the Old Testament. We always have to be really careful about what lens we interpret the scriptures through, because it can really change the meaning of the scriptures themselves. And so these guys coming out of the Maccabean revolt, having freedom, and then Rome comes in and just, I mean, remember, Rome taking over was still pretty fresh. It hadn't even been 100 years, I don't think, from the time Pompey took over to the time of Christ. So they still had, you probably still had old timers there that said, my grandpa remembered the heyday of the Hasmoneans. You know, my great grandpa fought with Judas Maccabee. there was still that lineage, still that mindset. And so they're interpreting the passages in Isaiah, the passages in Micah, the passages in the Psalms, through the lens of the Maccabean revolt. And they were expecting, especially the Zealots, but everybody was too. The Zealots were actually ready to make it happen. They were going to be the army. They were trying to have the army prepared for the Messiah to come and use to drive these guys out. But all of the people were expecting this conquest of the Romans in Judas Maccabee fashion. So that's why we have to be really, really careful about our presuppositions, about our biases, about our American ideology as well, going back into the scripture and interpreting the scripture through an American lens. We got to try to take those things and check them at the door and try to be as objective as we can to get the true message from the scriptures and not read too much into it. Try not to read anything into it, but it's very difficult not to do that. Questions, comments? All right, so next week we'll dive into the book of Daniel a little bit. I'll probably finish up with some discussion about the interaction between the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes, possibly. I know we've done that a little bit, but I want to dive in a little bit more into the interactions between them so that we can see how that all worked out in the power dynamic of the time of Christ. And if there's anything that I haven't touched on that people are interested in, let me know, and I'd be happy to study it out and work on that. So anybody else? Any comments, questions?